Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. And on the show today, we're considering two markedly different calls for police department reform. Some believe there's no other way to take bias and brutality and a blue code of silence out of the Minneapolis Police Department, but to remake the department from the ground up. Here's Minneapolis City Council President Lisa Bender on defunding the department.
This is not the first time that police have killed a community member in recent years. We've had a number of very painful deaths of Jamar Clark, of Justine Damon. We have done every reform in the book. I mean, there are more layers and more and farther we can go with reform. But, you know, to see George Floyd killed in the way he was, I think just shows to our community that these incremental steps we've been taking are not working to solve this toxic culture in our police department, to break through the lack of accountability, and our community is demanding that we do more.
Now, others, including the House Congressional Black Caucus, believe departments can be changed from within with more federal oversight, the tracking of police misconduct, and ending laws that shield officers from accountability. Here's Representative Karen Bass, chair of the Congressional Black Caucus.
Never again should the world be subjected to witnessing what we saw on the streets in Minneapolis, the slow murder of an individual by a uniformed police officer.
We're also hearing specific recommendations from the Eight Can't Wait campaign, which has the endorsement of some Black Lives Matter activists. So what do citizens want? And that's what we're here to find out this morning. Are you convinced that bias and violence cannot be routed out of large city police departments like Minneapolis, and that it's time for the city to do away with the department, to change it as we know it? Or do you think federal legislation on accountability and deadly force can do what is necessary? So I'm asking you this morning to weigh in on what you think about these calls for defunding or abolishing the police department. And we'll get into some of the nuance of that. What do you think about that? Or do you believe that federal legislation can come in on accountability and deadly force and do what's necessary to make those changes? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. We're going to talk with Minneapolis City Council member Steve Fletcher a little later in the show, but we're starting now with Ginger Charles. She's a retired police sergeant. She's a full-time faculty and chair at Cabrillo College in California, where she teaches criminal justice, and she's with us today from Santa Cruz. Ginger, good to have you back on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Mickey Kendall is with us. She's author of Hood Feminism, Notes from the Women That a Movement Forgot, and she's an activist, and she's with us from outside of Chicago. And Mickey, welcome to the show. It's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Ginger, there have been calls for abolishing police departments before, and I don't know how many, you know, city councils across the country have supported it the way the Minneapolis City Council apparently does. So you have experience as a police officer. You also get deep into police policy. What comes to mind when you hear about an idea like it's time to abolish the police department?
So as I've stated before in your show, and my last book illustrated that, I've been researching about police culture for many, many years. And I can tell you that it's not going to be one size fits all. And so when I hear that Minneapolis is looking at abolishing the police department, it's a very interesting perspective, because if you look at what the history is there and what has recently happened, I'm not sure what else would work at this particular time. I think one of the interesting things about considering abolishing it is what is the backup plan? What services are there for violent crime that comes up as well? So we can't look systemically at, okay, well, what actually started this particular murder? We have to be able to have folks that actually respond to that. But this is going to take community involvement, because if you're talking about defunding, you're talking about actually turning services back over to other organizations and agencies. And so the responsibility lies with all of us in order to get these social problems out of the police department and into the correct agencies.
Mickey, have you lost all confidence that some of these police departments, including Minneapolis, with these records of police violence payouts, right, to victims, mm-hmm. and some of the other issues that we've been hearing about, have you lost confidence that they can be changed from within, or maybe with federal oversight, and that outside taking away the money and starting over is essentially the only way to go? How do you feel about that?
I'm from Chicago. I'm from the south side of Chicago, and we're the only city with a police torture center. So I'm going to say that there's a reason that in the George Floyd case, two of the officers had only been on the force for 4 days. There is no way to reform police departments, existing police departments in many places, Chicago, LA, New York. We've seen this in Seattle. We've seen this in so many places, including Minneapolis, where the culture of toxic, violent, I don't even know how to describe the brutality that is going on, that you can sit there calmly kneeling on a man's neck and staring into the camera like, well, so what? It's being taught. It's being passed down. We can no longer say, well, if we do this reform, if we bring out outside this, if we do that. I heard earlier on the show someone say that Minneapolis has done all of those things. Well, so is Chicago. And Chicago just had to admit that our already abysmally low solve rate for murder, which is something like 25%, may in fact be fraudulent, because we've had officers framing people again.
Wow. You know, you brought up the training issue, and we had former police chief Bill Finney on the show last week. And this is something that he specifically drilled in on when it comes to selecting high quality training officers. Let's listen to what he said.
It's common within a police culture to, when a rookie officer comes out of police academy, they learn all the things they're supposed to learn, all the things that are, quote, according to Hoyle. And then they go into a field training process where they actually work alongside a veteran police trainer and are evaluated on how they do their job on the street. Often, if you have the wrong FTOs, field training officer, if you have the wrong ones or other veterans out there say, hey, kid, forget about what you learned at academy. This is how we do stuff out here on the street.
Ginger, what are you hearing that? Is this a really essential part of the problem?
Yes. In fact, I've heard those same words when I was training. You know, forget about what you learned in the academy. This is how you do it. Now, fortunately for me, it wasn't the situations that Mickey described so accurately. I think that we have a significant problem within our training systems within all police departments. And that is very apparent by the situation that happened with George Floyd. You know, those two officers, one actually spoke up and then was quickly dismissed and had been on 4 days or whatever. And apparently he was the training officer. So, you know, if you have Minneapolis saying that we have done all these things, and I understand the frustration with that, that it's obviously not working in that culture. And I'm really getting tired of people talking about bad apples. It is really the barrel. It's the barrel that's causing this.
You know, it's funny, Ginger, that we had a show last week where we really took up that element of it. It's four or five officers and they're the bad apples and they make everybody else look bad. You don't buy that anymore. Why?
Well, if you take a look at just the latest situation with the killing of George Floyd, and you have two new officers, one's actually on his back and says, I don't think we should be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And then former Officer Chauvin says, no, we're not going to roll him over. And you see the fact that he's having to comply with that particular evil behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can just, that's a clear demonstration. That's, I don't know how to make it any clearer than that. That happens all the time in police agencies. And I'm not saying in every police agency, but I'm just going to say it's It's very common.
Let me take some calls here from Teresa in Minneapolis. Hi, Teresa. What's your experience with this?
Well, as a victim of police misconduct, I can tell you that there are many issues to address, but I just wanted to say that I do think there is an opportunity for reform and not just outright abolishment. That the Office of Police Misconduct Review in Minneapolis Office of Civil Rights is a toothless tiger. They have cases, including mine, that are over 3 years old that are sitting on the chief's desk waiting for the implementation of the recommendation for discipline. And that's an area that could be reviewed. Another huge issue that is just coming up in the United States Senate and Congress right now is the issue of qualified immunity, allowing police to do whatever they want to do. And the defense of the city of Minneapolis and every city across this country is that they have qualified immunity. They don't have qualified immunity in the federal civil rights law, but the courts have allowed qualified immunity in many instances, and I know because there's one coming up next week.
Okay. Let me, Teresa, I appreciate you brought up two really big issues here, and I want to start with what you said about the misconduct reviews. Mickey, I'm familiar with some of the things that your mayor, Lori Lightfoot, talked about. She was head of a police review board. During the campaign, she talked about how what they're doing is often secretive. It's not transparent enough. There's not enough of an outcome that the community trusts. Why are these review boards so difficult to reform?
So most of the time, the police review boards are made up of former officers, sometimes political appointees. It's not as though there's a reason for them particularly to enforce. I'm going to point out that the current head of the review board was beaten by a police officer 5 times in Chicago during the protests. And he felt obligated to make it seem as though, well, you know, it could have been worse. I'm okay. Because there's a certain level of fear attached. We know that, and this is really getting deep in some ways into Chicago politics, we know that the officers or that the lawyers involved with convicting Laquan McDonald's killer,
yep,
they died. They were killed in their home. So you have to ask, and sure, we don't know what happened. We don't know how those murders occurred, but you have to ask in a culture where officers feel free to brutalize people on camera, where they feel free to threaten people with violence, where at least in Chicago's case, we had officers still on the force with multiple felony charges, sometimes as many as 9 or 10.
Wow.
There comes a point where you have to say, okay, I know we keep talking about gangs and violence, but these police forces have become sources of violence. And a lot of conversation around defunding also needs to include demilitarization, because so many of these officers are now strapped like they're going to war with communities they're supposed to be protecting and serving. I know we've told them they don't actually have to do that, but in theory, they're supposed to be taking care of people. We're not sending them out dressed to take care of anything. They've got guns, they've got handcuffs, they've got batons and all kinds of things. Where's the first aid kit? Where's the training for mental health? Where's anything? I mean, at some point you have to say we have created a militia and told them that their targets are the citizens.
Ginger, Mickey reminds me of a conversation we had last week with Professor Nikki Jones from Berkeley, who says that too often police officers act as violence accelerators, not de-escalators. And I have to say, with all of this video that's now, you know, what happened in Buffalo, what's happened here, what's happening in cities around the country, it's hard to deny that in a lot of cases, isn't it?
You know, I do want to remind folks that, you know, there are a lot of good officers, and we're seeing, you know, we are really seeing some of the worst And I would say that I do know that there are folks that do go out there and police officers who go out there and accelerate violence. And I have, you know, I've certainly witnessed that as well in my career as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also say that when we look at the culture, I'm going to be quite frank, if you have good officers in a bad system that are trying to do well, and then you have other officers that are being influenced by that bad system, you have a very, very sick system. At this point in time, I really do believe we have many, many police officers who are sick, destructive, suffering from all kinds of depression and anxiety, as well meeting community in crisis. And
wow.
So there's no other option other than to have violence.
Ginger Charles is one of our guests this morning. If you've gotten in on the show, as we consider a number of proposals and an ongoing national debate here about how to reform police departments, we're hearing from the Congressional Black Caucus, which unveiled legislation yesterday that includes more measures for accountability and federal oversight. We're hearing from the Minneapolis City Council that is essentially saying defund the department. We'll talk with City Council member Steve Fletcher at the bottom of the hour. And then we're hearing from organizations like Eight Can't Wait. And these are eight specific ideas to de-escalate police violence right now. So Ginger with us, she's a retired police sergeant. She does a lot of policy research on criminal justice and teaches at Cabrillo College in California. Mickey Kendall with us. She's an activist. She's author of Hood Feminism, Notes from the Women That a Movement Forgot, and with us from Chicago, where they've had many issues with this as well. How about you? When you hear calls to defund the Minneapolis Police Department, are you convinced that the bias and the violence that we see indicated on these videos really can't be routed out of a department like Minneapolis except for basically starting over? Do you think federal legislation and maybe some of these ideas from the Black Lives Matter activists, is that the place that reform should really begin? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Carrie MPR, to Bill in Minneapolis. Hi, Bill. Hey, Bill.
Hi. Very nice to talk to you. I wanted to tell you a little bit about a very famous study. This was done by the sociologist John Van Manen, who now teaches at the Sloan School at MIT.
Mm-hmm.
He spent 2 years doing ethnographic work on the police department in Denver, where he actually went around with policemen for 2 years in their patrol cars and documented carefully what they were doing. It turned out that three-quarters of their time was spent in domestic disputes, and they were very, very ill-equipped to actually deal with these domestic disputes. But anybody who calls into a police station is going to get a visit from the police. They were mostly unsuccessful in resolving these domestic disputes.
Mm-hmm.
So for this reason, you know, the idea of restructuring policing in Minneapolis and in other cities, like, for instance, Camden, New Jersey, which has been in the news, makes an awful lot of sense to me, because you want to have people who are dealing with disorder, public disorder of any sort, in a way that really reflects their actual training. And police can't be a be-all and end-all for everything.
I think that's a really good point, Bill. I was thinking about this, Mickey, when I heard, you know, some of the details about defunding doesn't mean we'll shut the police department down and we'll just start completely over. It means starting to divert money to other offices. But who responds to the domestic violence call at 11:30 p.m. on a Saturday night? It's the police department. You know, they do in some ways have to be all things to all people. It's a lot of weight to put on these officers.
Well, here's the thing. We don't have to have police officers respond to domestic violence calls. We could have social workers. We could fund shelters and other mechanisms that we know actually do help victims of intimate partner violence leave. We could fund housing and all of these things so that it could be an officer escorts the social worker who shows up to pick up a woman and her kids, a man and his children, whatever, to take them to a safe place. We don't have to just send the cops. We don't have to send anyone who is armed, for instance. More often than not, I know that there's a narrative that, you know, domestic violence situations are incredibly volatile, and that's true. But more often than not, the police don't really help in those situations. They show up. They may or may not make the abusive partner leave. I can say from experience that having been in this situation myself, when the cops were called by my neighbors, mm-hmm. because my ex-husband had kicked down a door in our apartment, the police tried to take me to jail because I hit him back. So there's not necessarily this thing where you call the police for help and you get it. And that's not just for Black men or for Black people or for brown people. A lot of women in domestic violence situations have stories like mine, right? Marissa Alexander fired a warning shot and she almost went to jail for trying to defend herself. So policing isn't necessarily helpful.
Emmanuel agrees with that on Twitter, says, what percentage of calls to 911 from Minneapolis actually require an armed police officer, e.g. assault, robbery, etc.? I was skeptical of this approach until I heard one of your shows that suggested only about 10% of calls were like this. Ginger, and I want to ask Councilmember Fletcher about this. You know, what do you who investigates the homicides? Who investigates the frauds? Who shows up in the scenario that Mickey has described where there's a weapon present, where social workers aren't trained to deal with some violator who's holding a weapon on a woman? What do we do about that?
I completely understand Mickey's point of view, but I would say I wouldn't know who else would respond other than a police officer, and that may be my unfortunate shortcoming, having been a police officer for 27 years. That's what we're sworn to do. I would say, though, that I agree with what people have been talking about in this moment, with maybe not being functional or trained properly in certain areas or problems in society. So in other words, we may have a police officer that goes to domestic, doesn't have a clue how to actually handle a domestic because the training wasn't appropriate. And so then he or she is ineffective in that and will continue to be ineffective until they gain confidence or further training. So I would say I would be open to discussing this. I think one of the interesting things about this idea about defunding a police department is it's time to open up the police community and culture mm-hmm. and bring in community and have them stand there while we ask the question, how do you want to be police? And start taking in information from them about how this needs to happen.
Kendra called from St. Paul. She says, I'm a teacher. I'm raising three young boys. What we need to do is change the mindset of the police department. Maybe that means dismantling and starting from the ground up. The number one goal should be helping the community more than catching the bad guys. Sasha in the West Metro called. She said, I've been a victim of police brutality, but I was effectively silenced due to fear of police retaliation. I'd like to hear how your guests would advise those of us who haven't spoken up before. What should we do now? Mickey, that sounds like a perfect question for you.
So now is a wonderful time to speak up. And by speak up, I mean, yes, talk to the state's attorney, talk to a civil attorney. One of the things that's been quasi-effective, and I'm not saying it's perfect in Chicago, has been bringing up over and over again how much police brutality lawsuits cost. Chicago, where we famously closed all those schools, we spent over $1 billion settling these lawsuits.
Wow.
Taxpayers are taking that hit. So one of the reforms could, in fact, be making officers to some degree carry some kind of insurance, somehow be personally responsible for their own misconduct. Because right now, they don't even have to pay for their lawyers. The police union covers that. They don't face any personal consequences, even if they lose the lawsuit the city has to settle. They go right back out on the street. At one point, I saw a stat that said something like 15% of officers are responsible for approximately 85% of these lawsuits. We could start with firing that 15%, sure, but we also have to change the culture so that we maybe don't get to a point where someone is armed in a domestic violence situation. I know we're thinking of this as how do we respond to the existing problem? And sure, that is a question that we'll have to figure out.
Right.
But we could also stop creating the problem. We could also stop handing guns to people who want to shoot their partner. Oh, that, yeah, I know.
Just want to note here, you hear Mickey talking about allowing police officers to be more liable for police misconduct. That's one of the recommendations in the Congressional Black Caucus plan. Also, a national database of police misconduct. And as we get a look at the latest news here, I want to leave you with a couple of statistics here for context. Both of these startled me. I think they'll startle you. The Washington Post reported yesterday that despite commitments from police departments across America over the last 5 to 6, 7 years, police officers have shot and killed almost 1,000 people each year since 2015, and a disproportionate number of those killed are Black Americans. So when you think about the commitments that we're hearing from police departments to reform, and you look back over the number of Americans who have been killed by police officers, disproportionately Black, you see almost 1,000 every year since 2015. And then here's research from St. Kate's University here in St. Paul that finds that Minneapolis police also stopped and arrested a disproportionate number of Native American women. 20% of Native women were arrested and booked compared to 4% of white women. That gives you some context for what we're talking about this morning and how serious the debate is about changes. Mickey Kendall with us. She's an activist and author of Hood Feminism, Notes from the Women That a Movement Forgot. Ginger Charles, she's a retired police sergeant and full-time faculty chair at Cabrillo College, where she works on police policy research. And we're joined by Steve Fletcher. He's Minneapolis City Council member, represents Ward 3. Council Member Fletcher, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Carrie.
I think you've seen a lot of discussion about what defunding actually means. I'd love to hear your own take on this. What is it?
It means not investing any more money in this police department. We need to stop funding a police department that is not representing our values, that is behaving in ways that are dangerous to our residents, and we need to start fresh with something entirely new.
So you are sending a pretty strong message also to Chief Arredondo, whom I thought many of the council members had some faith in, that you don't have confidence any longer in his ability to make the kind of change that he says he can make. Is that right?
You know, unfortunately, I think that is right. I personally respect and like Chief Arredondo on a personal level. And I think that if anybody could have led this department to a better place, it would have been him. And I think we have just seen undeniable evidence that it cannot be done. I believe it's ungovernable. He has made attempts at discipline that have been rejected by arbitrators, and he has made attempts at reform that have been ignored or aggressively fought by the Federation. And we just don't have a way for even a dynamic leader with a vision to reform this department.
Councilmember, when you say it's ungovernable, are you saying there are a core of police officers who simply, they're rogue in some way, they simply cannot be managed, and they influence other officers around them? Or would you say that's the predominant nature of the department right now?
You know, I think in general, it's the predominant nature of the department. I think there's a culture.
Wow.
I think there are good people who intended to enter a career of civil service and service to the community. But I think that the culture of the department is toxic, and there are things that we have done, large and small. There's the newsmaking stuff. There's the things that are generating multimillion dollar lawsuits. But there's also the day-to-day. I get complaints from my constituents all the time that we can't get enforcement on you know, the way traffic works in our city. And because literally the cops have decided for themselves that they think bike lanes are stupid, and so they just don't enforce them.
I was reading something that you said to the Star Trib about a situation where you tried to invest less money into the department and put it into an office of violence prevention. And you said that the police department or police officers decided that they would slow walk calls to your ward. Was that just anecdotal that you were hearing from constituents? Were you able to find any kind of data to back that up?
Sure. I mean, they actually presented data that showed that they were failing to respond to 911 calls quickly. And, you know, you can see some patterns in that, but it's more anecdotal. And I think a lot of it is strategic. I think they are good at sometimes identifying who will put pressure on us and strategically underserving them. So showing up to a situation and saying, oh, sorry, our hands have been tied by the council. We can't help you. In situations where when you dig into it, that turns out to be nonsense, but that's the message they deliver. And of course, the constituents who hear that call us very angry because obviously they didn't get served by the city. And, you know, in general, politicians get held accountable for that and not city staff. And so police have been able to create pressure on politicians for generations and generations of our city's history.
Yeah. I want to take a couple calls for you that speaks specifically to some of the things that you're saying to Trevor in Rogers, Minnesota. Hi, Trevor. You're on with the city council member. What do you want to say?
Hi, Terry. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I just wanted to compare the police and the fire department. The fire department, by all accounts, does such a great job for us in the community. They respond to emergencies just like police do, and they keep us safe. And they have one very specific task, and that is fire. And so I don't understand why, like, for example, your other guest said that police officers try to be all things to all people. But in our experiences as humans, there's just no way that's possible. There's no way a police officer can respond to all of these different things appropriately. We ask far too much of them, and we expect far too much of them. I don't understand why we're not asking less of them like we do firefighters, who've got one job that they study down to a T, and they come in and they do that. And so I don't have the answers for what the new model should be, but I think that we can look at what we're doing now and compare it to the other things that we do successfully and see that policing and law enforcement is just not working.
Councilman,
so thanks. I'm going to hang up.
Thanks for the very good question there. Councilmember, is he right? We ask too much of the department, and this is an opportunity to change that?
Absolutely. So we've actually already started a 911 study group that involves city staff and community members who are really breaking down what are all the 911 calls that we currently send to MPD and what are the things that we should be responding differently and better to. Because our goal should always be the absolute right response to the right situation, right? And we can be more sophisticated about dispatch in the age of technology than we could maybe when we designed a system that had sort of three options. A dispatcher would say it's either ambulance, fire, or police. And basically, ambulance, you know what they go to. Fire, you know what they go to. And then anything else goes to police. It turns out, you know, that work group already identified mental health calls as a particular area where sending police is probably actually counterproductive in most cases.
Yeah.
They identified opioid overdoses as one of the things that's taking a lot of MPD staff time and really should be treated as a health emergency, but we're sending police to those calls. And so looking at ways that we could identify a better city response that actually produces a better outcome is one of the goals of this. And I actually think that a massive portion, maybe as much as 70 or 80% of the calls that we currently send to MPD would actually be better responded to by other types of response.
Yeah, Mickey, earlier you suggested this when we were talking about domestic violence situations. I guess I'm wondering if you have confidence that no matter who it is, because somebody from the police department is probably going to respond to somebody who is perhaps has a weapon or is perceived to be violent in that moment. Are you confident enough that you can change that fear response. You know, you can manage that fear response on the part of the officer that we wouldn't just eventually get into a cycle of this again with whoever is responding to those kinds of calls.
I think, unfortunately, we have created a situation right now, literally as we're on the phone, the video has just come out in New Jersey where the police pulled someone over for speeding. His car was breaking down and the officer invites him to sit in his car and then somehow shoots him 6 times. Even though there's no weapon, there's no threat, he gets upset that the man is getting out of the car, that he's not under arrest in. So when we're looking at this, I have to say that an officer with a gun who apparently has some form of panic always gone going is a bad idea in a domestic violence situation, in a child abuse situation. There are a lot of places here where apparently the man with the gun that's a danger is the officer who's in theory supposed to be helping. So maybe we need to back off on sending someone with the gun. Other police forces in other countries don't automatically send in officers with a weapon, for instance.
What do you think, Ginger?
I think it's an interesting point. My research partner is in the United Kingdom, and we were talking about the difference between the response here for the protests versus over there. And his response was that the protests were mostly peaceful and the police chose to have absolutely no presence on the street. And then, of course, most of their force is unarmed. And in fact, they take a vote every year to remain unarmed. I've interviewed several officers from over there and they feel like that's very important that they remain unarmed. And it's interesting, their thoughts is that, quote unquote, they're macho because they don't carry a gun, whereas here, the officers that I've interviewed feel macho because we do carry a gun. So the culture is really completely different. It would be absolutely fantastic. The unfortunate thing is that we have so many guns on the street. And so I don't know how to respond to a situation for a social worker if somebody else is armed on the street. Now, you know, that may be a relatively low number, but those are some of the things that we're going to have to take a hard look at, that we all should be taking a hard look at when we look at police reform.
Councilmember Fletcher, I mean, I'm sure that's not the first time you've thought of that, but now it becomes much more urgent as you think about how to remake this department. How do you handle the fact that we have a lot of guns out there?
You know, I think that is the biggest challenge and the biggest fear that people are facing. And we certainly have to have a way to respond when there is an actual and legitimate threat of real violence. And so that's going to be part of the community conversation that we have to have over the next year is what does that look like? What kind of guardrails are put on it so that we trust it more? What kind of limitations are put on that? But we do have to be able to respond to so much more without guns. I actually really love the point about the systems in other countries, because we actually asked officers a couple of years ago if they would come to a couple of neighborhood meetings without guns, because some members of the community just don't feel comfortable around guns and made that request. And the officer's response was, well, then we're not invited. Like, without they literally were afraid to go to a neighborhood meeting without carrying a weapon. And when we asked about it, they said, well, we think we'd be targeted if we were out without weapons. We think, you know, they've got all these sort of fantasies of people out to get them. And I just feel like the people who are serving us right now are so afraid of their own city, and it's not their city. They don't actually live in a city for 94% of them or something. And so we have a real problem with who's doing the policing and how they view the city. And as someone who's knocked on almost every door in the city at some point, as a political activist and as an elected official, and never felt the need to carry a gun, I and gone to some very contentious neighborhood meetings where certainly people were managing a lot of emotions. I don't understand being afraid of being out in community. And I don't understand not feeling like you can go talk to somebody without carrying a weapon. So I think we really have to readjust our mindset on that, and that's part of the opportunity of reimagining public safety in Minneapolis.
I want to grab another call for you from Tony in Edina. Hi, Tony.
Hi, good morning. I guess one element of the conversation I feel like absent is just sort of the questions around unintended consequences of defunding police and the importance for economic growth and safety to our culture. The thin line that exists between a lawless society where public figures, you know, in places like Mexico don't feel safe or could be threatened. We don't have that situation here. We put a lot on the police officers. I think there are a lot of good questions being asked here. But you show me somebody that wants to sign up for a job for $50,000 a year where they now have to take personal liability to do their job, walk into a domestic violence situation where they don't know what's going on. Someone could be on drugs. They could have weapons. And they're unarmed. I cannot imagine a world where rational people want to sign up for a job like that. It is a dangerous occupation.
Council member?
You know, I think that we have city staff today who go into situations who are not armed and resolve conflicts in a variety of situations. I would point to our, you know, rental inspectors who are navigating situations between tenants and landlords and walking sometimes into some very heated and frustrating situations. I think that there's a lot of evidence that we can manage conflict and that we can manage human emotion and manage the relationships between people with tools other than weapons. And I take the point that there's some risk in this, but I think there's we have in many ways hamstrung ourselves by overestimating that risk. In many ways, I think are struggling to imagine the future, but I get that because there's things that are scary about it. But I think many times, particularly the voices within the police department overestimate the risk when they're talking about the work that they do and the chance of something harmful happening to them. And I think that that shapes their decision making.
You know, Mickey, I was thinking about this, though. You know, we want exceptional people to want to serve in law enforcement. We want exceptional people who, you know, have the strong enough moral compass to, when they see what Officer Chauvin was doing, to step up without fear of whatever retaliation and say, that's not acceptable. So we want those kinds of people on the department. And yet what Tony just said is a good point. How are we going to attract those kinds of people to the service?
I'm going to point out that those people have been attracted and end up quitting because of the toxic culture. I'm also going to point out, and I've been looking at budgets, police budgets all over the country for something else I'm working on, mm-hmm. that in many places, officers are sometimes making as much as $200,000 a year, $100,000 a year, $150,000 a year. They're getting paid this kind of money in a combination of salary and overtime to apparently misbehave and drive out good officers. So the idea that we need to attract good people, attracting good people was never the problem. The problem is that for many of them, the risk versus reward falls into, well, if I try to do the right thing, am I going to get shot by a fellow officer, right? We've seen this with Serpico. We've seen this over and over again. We have all of this data that shows the problem is that absolute power corrupts absolutely is one of those cliche sayings. That's unfortunately very true. We're not attracting the best people because generally someone who wants to strap on a gun and gets pumped up at doing violence to other people isn't going to be a good person.
Ginger, to Tony's point, and then I guess my follow question on that.
Oh, yeah, maybe I'm just the oddball. I would sign up for that. I do believe that you do the right thing all the time, and that's how I did police. I do think we can attract the correct people. Changing the mission so it is attractive to those police officers who want to do the right thing but are discouraged because of the culture. I do agree with Mickey that does happen quite often, and I do agree that there's a tremendous amount of money that officers are paid across the country. It is an amazing profession when you have the mindset of, you know, of the people, by the people, for the people, that you're going out there to serve the public rather than to abuse the public. And there are many, many officers who do that and are very, very discouraged at this particular time. So I think that there are officers that would do that. Is that the solution? Maybe not, but it is one of those things that we need to have the conversation. We need to lay everything on the table mm-hmm. and then pick and choose and see what will work.
Councilmember Fletcher, what happens now? I mean, how do you begin with this?
So we have sort of two tasks in front of us as a city. We have to take actions that protect our city from the harm of the actions that the Minneapolis Police Department has been taking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to require some pretty drastic structural change, some of which is going to need to happen, you know, as quickly as we can manage it. And then we need to go deep into our community to design the real solution for the long run. That we need to do at least a year of really deep community engagement with everybody. Now that everybody's paying attention because of this tragedy, because of the drastic actions that we're proposing, now is the time for us to be talking to every single Minneapolis resident about what makes you feel safe, what are the things that you like about what you perceived about the current system, and what are the things that we can no longer tolerate about the way the system has been operating, so that we can design a public safety system that is oriented towards community service, that is oriented towards our community values, and that makes everybody in our community feel safe.
I mean, you're going to have to do, I would think, a lot of community education about this. Because,
absolutely.
Right? Because many people are going to hear this as, so I see somebody trying to get into my house and I call the police and they don't show because we've defunded the police department, which is not what this means. But there will be a lot of misperception, I think, initially, don't you?
I do. And honestly, the most important thing that people can do is to align the public narrative that they've absorbed with their own personal experiences. Most people, if you ask them, when's the last time you called the police and was it actually helpful?
Mm-hmm.
Some people will have stories of actually being harmed by that experience, but more people will have stories like the ones that I've had as a white male living in Minneapolis, which is that, you know, I got robbed, I called the police. You know, they came and took down my report, which was basically an insurance adjustment function at that point. I really didn't need two people with guns to come into my home because they did no follow up. There was no actual capacity to create either justice or, you know, any kind of repair for what had happened to me. I was treated very rudely in the process, right? And so when you sort of think about, like, well, is that what we want our city doing?
Mm-hmm.
Is that how we want our response to be? An awful lot of people, when they actually stop and think about, compared to the narrative that has always equated safety with policing, if you actually think about what's your experience been, you start to be more open to changing the system. We're not starting from a system that worked. We're starting from a system that I deeply believe we could design something better.
Councilmember, I really appreciate the time this morning. Thanks. I know you're busy and you've had a lot of requests. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Steve Fletcher is a Minneapolis City Council member. He represents Ward 3. Mickey, thank you so much for your insight and for being on the show. By the way, I've read the book. It's excellent. We were trying to find a time to talk with you about it. I'm really glad you could be on the show today. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Mickey Kendall is the author of Hood Feminism, Notes from the Women That a Movement Forgot. And Ginger, thank you for always being available to us. We really appreciate it with your insight.
My pleasure.
Ginger Charles, retired police sergeant and full-time faculty chair at Cabrillo College in California, where she teaches criminal justice.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.